So, there's this Egyptian god named Isis, no relation to the terror group. And she is married to this Egyptian god named Osiris. And he's the ruler of Egypt. And wouldn't you know, along comes an evil god named Set. And Set wants the throne of Egypt, so he kills Osiris, chops up his body, and spreads his pieces all over the world. Having removed his rival, Set takes the throne of Egypt, but Isis, you can imagine, is distraught by this. And so Isis brings together her husband's pieces of his body and resurrects him in the underground world, and then conceives a child by him, a god named Horus. Interesting. Resurrection in Egyptian mythology. Now, if you happen to believe and buy into authors like D.M. Murdoch or Tom Harper, what they will tell you is that this Egyptian resurrection story is proof that Christianity borrowed its major ideas from mythology of other cultures, including the idea of resurrection. And so for them, the story of Jesus' resurrection was simply Christians stealing Egyptian resurrection mythology. Now, I have reasons to believe this is a grand oversimplification. But even if it is true, my question this morning for us is this: which resurrection do you believe in? You see, what happens in Egyptian mythology is interesting. Horus, son of the resurrected Osiris, grows up and promises his father that he will seek out vengeance on Set and reclaim the throne for himself. So that's what he does. The good god Horus and the evil god Set end up locked in this violent battle for 80 years. And those 80 years tell the story of repetitive battles, cycles of fighting, revenge, and retaliation. And these stories are strange. In one battle, they both turn into animals and battle each other, trying to get the upper hand. At one point, Horus steals Set's testicles, as you do, to which Set steals Horus's eye. And then at one point, Isis, mother of Horus, tries to help out by throwing a harpoon at Set and killing him, but accidentally misses, and it hits Horus. And Horus, as you can imagine, upset that his mother did this to him, decides to chop off her head. And then, of course, Isis has the power to resurrect, so she resurrects herself, sticks a cow head on her, and boom, she's good to go, which is why we find a lot of cow heads in Egyptian mythology. 80 years they battle back and forth, 80 years of brutal fighting, until finally Horus defeats Set and is crowned Lord of all the earth, the god who once again established order and justice. It's a resurrection story that leads to revenge. And so my question is, what resurrection story do you believe in? And yet, the answer for me is not quite simple. Because the answer for me is this: I know two things. The first is this: I have lived under Horus's resurrection story. That's a story that I know very well. Everything from the petty to much, much bigger things. I remember it was April Fool's Day. Happy April Fool's Day. That's all to you. April Fool's Day about 10 years ago, and I decided my coworker Shane deserved a little prank. And so I went to his office and put Vaseline on the ear thing of his telephone. Yeah, pretty simple joke. And when he got to the office, I called him. He picked up the phone. Funny, Brad, you got my ear covered in Vaseline. And I remember him looking at me and saying, "Revenge will be mine." Oh, yeah, okay. It started off light enough. I started receiving phone calls, and I'd pick up the phone. "Hey, is your car still going for $500? "What? What are you talking about? Fun. I don't know what you're talking about." I went out to my car and realized he had put on the back in yellow chalk, "For sale, $500 or best offer," with my phone number. So that's how it started. I mean, fair enough. Then I came into the office one day and noticed that my office was filled with balloons. And so I had to go in and pop them all before I could go to work. Things were starting to escalate. About a week later, I went into my room and discovered the whole office was covered in styrofoam cups filled with water. The difficulty was they were all stapled together as well. And so disassembling them took some time. My victim was coming back for vengeance, and it didn't stop there. This one threw me over the edge. I vowed never to pick a fight I couldn't win. I came into my office one morning and found it was not there at all. Every single thing had been taken out, taken to the... Yes, agreed. To the basement of the church. And there in a little cubby, my whole office was set up. Bookshelves, everything. And I had to move my books office all back. I had to surrender at that point. Sorry. It's funny, though, because in little petty stuff like that, we live under the story of Horace, a victim who comes back for revenge. And it's not just that we live under the story of Horace, it's that we crave the story of Horace. I remember the very first movie I saw was Beauty and the Beast in the theater, and then my parents wouldn't let me go to the theater, so I went and snuck out and saw Twister, and that was the second movie I saw. But then the third movie I saw was Braveheart, and I was too young to get in, and my brother snuck me in, and I learned a valuable lesson because I bought one of the big pops and I drank it too quickly, had to pee in the middle of it, so that's not good. But I went to Braveheart, and I remember this was the first time. You've all seen Braveheart. No spoilers, it was in the 90s. If you haven't seen it by now, you probably won't. But his wife is killed by the English overlords. And there's that scene where he's coming to surrender, and he has his hands behind his head, and in that last moment, with a terrifying look that only Mel Gibson can give, he pulls out his weapon and proceeds to basically destroy an entire English settlement. And I remember in that moment, just, yes, kill them all. Just, they're evil. Look what they've done to you. I've never felt up until that point, I'd only seen two movies in the theater, but to that point, the visceral emotional reaction of get them. You see, Horace's story is not just a simple myth. It's a story that we've told for millennia in thousands of different forms. In fact, I'm pretty sure it is humanity's favorite story. Because at its heart, Horace's story is the story of a victim who has been wronged, who comes back to establish peace, order, and justice by getting even, revenge, retaliation, violence. And I would say this, in terms of stories, there is nothing more satisfying than the victim who acts in violence and retribution. In a story, everything a victim does to get even is right, it's good, it's justified, and so we crave it, and we cheer for it, and we live under the story of Horace. We find hundreds of different ways to retell the same basic story. We live under Horace's story. It's the reason we endlessly go to war. It's embedded in the wearisome rhetoric of our politics. It's at the very core of our legal system and our prison system. It's what occupies our social media feeds. And beyond that, it's the story we live into relationally so often as well. Our collective story is often the story of Horace, the victimized, the wronged, the wounded, the hurt, the betrayed. Get justice by getting even. In other words, I would say this, Horace is our divine model. In fact, both culturally and individually, I could say our currency in life is in Horace we trust. Which brings me to a strange feature about the resurrection stories that I never noticed before. In all of the Gospels, plus in the book of Acts, the news of Jesus' resurrection is met with something peculiar, something I never noticed before. The news of Jesus' resurrection is met with fear, which is both interesting and kind of bizarre. In Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, the news of Jesus' resurrection is met with fear. In Matthew, the woman leave the empty tomb with both fear and joy. In Luke and John, the disciples are hiding in rooms out of fear. And then, of course, there's the Gospel of Mark, which is perhaps the oddest of all Gospels because of the way it ends. Most people believe the book of Mark ends in verse 8 of chapter 16. What comes after that isn't found in the earliest manuscripts. And so think about this. This is a very odd way to describe Jesus' resurrection. This is how it ends in Mark. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome bought spices so that they might go to anoint Jesus' body. Very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they were on the way to the tomb and they asked each other, "Who will roll the stone away from the entrance of the tomb?" But when they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. "Don't be alarmed," he said. "You're looking for Jesus the Nazarene, who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him? But go and tell his disciples and Peter, he's going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you." Trembling and bewildered, the woman went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. That's how it ends, which is bizarre. We associate joy and hope with Easter. Christ is risen. And yet in the Gospels, the news of Jesus' resurrection is initially met with fear. Why? Why is there fear on Easter Sunday? Why does the news of Jesus' resurrection inspire fear? And I can only think this. It's because in Horus we trust. This is the story we love to tell and live by. And what the story reminds us of is this. When a victim returns with power, that is never good news for the perpetrator. I mean, imagine being one of the disciples. You hear the news of Jesus being resurrected. "Hey, disciples, remember that Jesus guy who spent 3 years loving you, training you?" "Yeah, of course we remember him. Amazing guy." "Yeah, and do you remember how in his darkest hour you all stabbed him in the back, abandoned him, and betrayed him?" "Yeah, we've got some regrets around that." "Well, I bet you do. And guess what? He's back, and he's looking for you." How do you respond to that news? With fear. I was going to put it in common vernacular, but I see some kids in the room. And I imagine it kind of like this. "Hey, disciples, remember the guy you victimized by betraying and abandoning in his darkest hour? Well, he's back and he wants to see you." "Oh, you can fill in fiddlesticks. You can fill in the blank. Fear. Fear. Because you know how the story plays out. We all do. If you were party to having crucified Jesus, if you had abandoned or betrayed Jesus, had you simply stood on the sidelines or washed your hands of it all, you might be afraid that justice or retribution or revenge is coming your way. Because that's the way the world works. That's the stories we tell. That's the story we live under. And so I'd say this, you see, Easter is not good news for the guilty. It's not good news to find out that your victim is alive and looking for you. We know what's coming. My brother got married in the Dominican Republic 3 or 4 years ago. And there's about 50 of us down there. And one day we're all having a good time around the pool. And up comes this guy riding a Segway. And he comes over to our group, there's about 50 of us there, and it's like, "Hey, I'm renting out my Segway here. Does anybody want to rent it out?" It's like $50 an hour. And I'm like, "Ah, man, this looks like fun." I said, "Would you mind if I tried the Segway, you know, and just get a feel for it?" He's like, "Okay, okay." So I hop up onto the thing, and he's holding it. He's like, "You got to be careful. This isn't, you know, this isn't a toy." I'm like, "Ah, I got it. In fact, I've ridden one of these before in Vancouver, way back in the day. I got it." So he lets go, and I careen forward into the patio set, tumble over, and break a lamp. And I'm embarrassed, as you might be. I stand up, everyone's laughing, and the guy's like, "Oh my goodness, you okay? Sorry about that." I said, "You know, I'm not going to rent the Segway. I think I've had enough of the Segway for today." And everyone was like, "You're an idiot." I'm like, "I know. I guess I'm not great with balance." Yeah. And so we carried on having fun. But the next day, people kept coming up to me saying, "Segway guy's looking for you." Looking for me? About what? I said, I don't know, but he's looking for you. I said, is there something wrong? He said, I don't know. He's telling everyone around the pool, he's looking for you. And so that whole day, I lived as a fugitive. Every time I went around a corner, I'm like, all right, no Segway guy there. I can head to the pool, I think. He was looking for me. And I don't know, he might have been wanting to make sure I was okay. But my immediate thought was, he's going to want me to pay for something. And I don't know what I did to the Segway. It looked fine. I realized I broke a lamp. But the whole time I lived that final day on the resort in fear, he's looking for you. Thinking, I don't want to get caught. Because it's never good news when you do something wrong and find out the person you did something wrong to is looking for you. It's not good to find out that your victim is alive and looking for you. We've seen the Hollywood movies. We know how the story goes. It's in Horace we trust. And so fear on Easter morning makes sense because everything in human psychology and human history, including the Bible up to this point, suggests Easter is never good news for the perpetrators. If a victim returns, it's for one purpose, to get even. And you know, there's a danger in reading this story from a casual distance, a story to reflect on rather than inhabit. You see, the story invites us in. It invites us, I would say this, to see Jesus as the divine and archetypal victim. And when we enter into the story, instead of reading it from a distance, suddenly this story becomes very personal. And I think what the story whispers to us is this: your victim is back with power and is looking for you. Gulp. Fear. Because here's the thing, every single one of us has been a perpetrator. All of us have wounded, betrayed, crucified. All of us have created victims somewhere in life. And in the gospel narratives, Jesus stands in as the archetypal victim we have all created. And guess what? The victim has returned and is looking for you. And that's why the resurrection story initially inspires fear. Rowan Williams writes this about the Easter narrative in the Bible. The preaching of the resurrection, as we have seen, is not addressed to an abstract audience. The victim involved is the victim of the hearers. We too are insistently and relentlessly in Jerusalem, confronted therefore with a victim who is our victim. Your victim is back with power and wants to chat about some things. But then something totally unexpected happens in the story, an unexpected twist in the plot, because the victim's first words to us are this: peace be with you. And it's interesting because in John 20, when Jesus first appears to his disciples, he repeats that line three times: peace be with you. Why three times? Because it can't be overstated, because we need reminders that the story isn't going the way we thought it would. Peace be with you. Let me say this. Jesus' resurrection was and is the most complete and profound revelation humanity has ever received of God. It is the most decisive disclosure of what the way, the truth, and the life actually look like. This event is the ultimate revelation of the heart of God, and what it reveals to us is this: Jesus, the ultimate manifestation of God, the divine, is the forgiving victim. The forgiving victim. And what Jesus' resurrection announces is that the hope of the world is found in the forgiving victim. But that's hard to trust because it's in Horus we trust. So, which resurrection do we believe in? I was riding with Huxley in the car earlier this week, and we were talking about Easter, and I was trying to explain the cultural appropriation that has taken over Easter and how something, I have no idea where it came from, but suddenly Jesus' resurrection is about bunnies and chocolate. And he's like, well, does Jesus hide in the egg? And I'm like, my goodness, it is it's so hard to explain to kids what's going on. I said, no, it's about Jesus coming back to life. And he said this: what does that mean? I thought, what a profound question. What does that mean? Because I've said this before, if somebody If we heard on CNN News that somebody in India had come back to life, it might be interesting on the news cycle for about 24 hours, and then I think we'd stop caring. So what does it mean? What does it mean? I think to believe in Jesus' resurrection means at least two things. First, it means this. You want to know God? You want to experience God? You want to see God? Look to the forgiving victim. That's where God's at work. Where is God found? In the forgiving victim. Second, though, to believe in Jesus' resurrection has come face to face with the profound challenge of Easter, which is this: the way of Jesus is to become the forgiving victim. Michael Harden says this: sacred violence has found a throne upon which to sit and rule. It can be found theologically, socially, and politically, reigning in almost every church and every movement. Justice is always selective when sacred violence rules. But newsflash, God does not indiscriminately take the side of the victim. God incarnates God's self in Jesus of Nazareth so that we might move beyond the persecutor-victim dynamics by calling us to be forgiving victims. Until retaliation is renounced in Christian ethics, politics, and theology, it remains pagan. And why? Because God cannot break through to the persecutor when the victim is retaliatory. And this challenge is rocking me this year in making Easter less fun. Because there's something beautiful about Jesus is risen and the hope about that. But there's a challenge in it that's rocking me this year. And it came to a head in an imaginary conversation I had with Jesus, which I do from time to time. It's an exercise I like to go through. And the reason I know it's imaginary is because I think Jesus in my head is far harsher with me than he really would be. But it's an imagination exercise. And I was preparing for this sermon. I had this exchange in my head. And it made me so uncomfortable. And hang with me, because I have a feeling I'm going to annoy some people here. But hang with me. There's more to come. But I was confronted with some hard questions, because I could hear Jesus saying to me, "Brad, is the message of the forgiving victim as the way and hope for the world really true? Really true?" Yes, 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 yes. I believe it's true. How true, Brad? How true? I think it's true. Is the message, Brad, of the forgiving victim true of the LGBT community? Oh. Let me ask you this, Brad. Is the message of the forgiving victim true for the woman of the Me Too movement? Oh. God, I don't want to talk about that. Brad, is the message of the forgiving victim true for Indigenous populations in Canada? Said Jesus, "I am white, straight, and male. I'm not allowed to talk about those things. This is getting uncomfortable." I said, "All right, Brad, let's get personal then. Your friend, the one who was raped repeatedly in church growing up, is the message of the forgiving victim true for them?" I said, "I don't want to talk about that. I don't want to go there." "All right, Brad, let's get really personal. Is it true for you, Brad? That person, Brad, you know who I'm talking about. You know exactly who I'm talking about. You ran into them on King Street 2 years ago. You hadn't seen them for years. You know exactly who I'm talking about. You ran into them on King Street, and you ran into them and had no words to say. You choked on your words because you had no idea what to say to them. Brad, is it true for you? Is the message of the forgiving victim true for you, Brad?" And I don't know what to say, because if I'm honest, it's in Horace I trust. And Michael Harden's words, they get stuck in my throat. Sure, God cannot break through to the persecutor when the victim is retaliatory, but maybe I don't want God to break through to the persecutor, at least not my own. And maybe that's why we trust Horace over Jesus, because as victims, we don't want God to break through. What we really want is revenge and to get even. And then I'm imagining this. And the image of Stephen and Paul, it rushes into my head. And I recall this tragic story. Saul stands as the persecutor. the archetypal persecutor in Acts 8. When you think persecutor, think Paul. He wears the badge of every oppressive force that can come to mind. He's a bigot. He's a colonizer. He is the patriarchy, all rolled into one. And he stands overseeing the persecution and death of Stephen. And as they're stoning Stephen, Stephen falls to his knees and cries out, "God, forgive them. Don't hold this against them." Stephen, who has given his life to the forgiving victim, in his moment of death becomes the forgiving victim. And in that moment, God breaks through. It's only after that moment that God can break through to Paul and say, "Why are you persecuting me?" Because Paul had seen the forgiving victim, and that's what changed his heart. And I believe what Jesus came to showcase for us is what a forgiving victim looks like, and in so doing, calls us to become forgiving victims as well. S. Mark Heim says this, "You see, the only models we have are to imitate the persecutors or imitate their victims. Passive acceptance merely reinforces the violent process. Direct resistance fosters more conflict and violence. We are like bound hostages whose every struggle pulls the knot tighter around us. But Christ opens a way out of this dilemma. His path to the cross eschews all violence. It exposes the evil of scapegoating at every step. The resurrection vindicates the victim and condemns the persecutors, but without turning to vengeance. But the bind still remains so long as the question is limited to which role one will choose in the standard plot. What is needed is to change the plot." And that's, I think, what Jesus' resurrection does. It changes the plot of the story. A plot change is available to us. In the old story, Horus story, there's only two roles to play, victim or persecutor. But Jesus introduces a new plot by playing and modeling a new character, the forgiving victim. You want to see God? Look to the forgiving victim. You want to be like God? Look to the forgiving victim. And as we receive forgiveness from the archetypal victim, we learn to forgive each other. We shut down the cycles of violence and hate and revenge. It's a story that asks us to believe and trust and play into it. But so often we don't really believe, do we? We believe in the gods of mythology. We believe in Horus. We believe in violence. We believe in hitting back and getting even. We believe in a justice that's selective and looks a whole lot like revenge and retribution. And the cycles of violence and pain and revenge will continue, and Horus will be our god. Unless we decide to believe, to really believe in the resurrection of Jesus. Faith in the resurrection is dangerous, though, because it means offering peace and forgiveness. And there are some, maybe many, who would respond to that offer of peace with violence. And that's the risk and the challenge of living into the resurrection, because Christ was killed, and so are his disciples. But that is also our greatest hope for a more peaceful world. I truly believe it. I would say this, my friends, this is the offense of the gospel right here. Apostle Paul wrote this, "We proclaim Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles." This message here is the offense of the gospel, what makes it offensive. It's foolishness. And I got to be honest, I'm so damn tired of hearing that the offense of the gospel is about getting prayer back into school or saying Merry Christmas or telling people they're somehow evil and wretched sinners. I wish those people would shut up, because this is the offense of the gospel. Good news, you get to play the forgiving victim. Good news, you get to respond to hate with love. Good news, you get to respond to your wounds with peace and forgiveness. That is foolish and a stumbling block, because it runs contrary to the stories we tell and the stories we live under. And I know you might say, "You don't know how I was hurt. You don't know my wounds, Brad. Where is the justice in being the forgiving victim?" You're right. I don't know. But what I feel so profoundly these days is this: our world is in a bloody mess. And the story we have been telling ourselves for millennia is not working. because all I see in the world is cycles of it. This side says we are the victim and they're the perpetrator. This side says, no, we're the victim, they're the perpetrator. On and on it goes, and all I can think to myself is this story isn't working. It's only driving the stakes of division and conflict and revenge deeper into the ground. What we need is a plot change. We need a new character in the story. And I believe Jesus has in the forgiving victim, and he's calling us to play that part as well. And you know, I don't doubt many of you are perhaps offended right now. You might be thinking, you know what, Brad, this is precisely how religion functions as a narcotic. It asks victims to put up with their lot in life and passively forgive those who have done wrong. It's just a recipe for the status quo. I hear you, I do. I worry about it myself. But it's interesting this year, after reading the resurrection stories, something popped out at me that was there the whole time, and I never saw it before, because I think what we see in the resurrection stories is Jesus models the forgiving victim, but he also shows us how the forgiving victim comes and acts. And it's profound to me. It's profound. It's found in both Luke and John's accounts. Here's what happens. Jesus offers the forgiving victim. As the forgiving victim, he offers peace. And then he shows his perpetrators his wounds. And then he invites them to eat together, to come back to the table. I've never seen it this way before, but it's there. It's right in the text. I mean, how does the forgiving victim come? Look at Luke's story. While they were talking about this, Jesus himself stood among them and said to them, "Peace be with you." They were startled and terrified and thought they were seeing a ghost. I said to them, "Why are you frightened, and why do doubts arise in your hearts? Look at this. Look at my hands and my feet. So see my wounds. See that it is myself. Now touch me and see. Feel my wounds. For a ghost does not have flesh and bones as you see that I have." And when he had said this, he showed them his hands and his feet. And while in their joy they were disbelieving and still wondering, he said to them, "You got anything to eat?" But I like how it begins. It has to start with the offer of peace. I was in my office a couple nights ago working away, and my children's bedroom is right next door, and I heard whispering. I thought, "Oh, great, they're not sleeping. That's never good." And then I realized it was Zoe whispering. I'm like, "What is she whispering? What is she whispering?" So I put my ear to the door, and I could hear her saying, "My name is Zoe. I speak for the trees. I come in peace." Okay. And it was weird. She kept saying it. It was like she was rehearsing. "My name is Zoe. I speak for the trees. I come in peace." Over and over. And I was going to go in, and then I was just kind of freaked out. So I just left left that. But there was this weird rehearsal. Whatever she was doing, she needed to rehearse what it meant to offer peace. I thought, that's fascinating. I think these stories call us to the same thing. It's not an easy task to offer peace to our perpetrators, those who have hurt or wounded us. But it's the model here. Offer peace. Show the wounds. Ask to the table. It's the same thing that happens in John. And it's again fascinating to me because there's no skipping over of the wounds. In both accounts, Jesus says, "See my wounds," and then "Feel them." And that's so critical to me in the offer of forgiveness and peace with those who have hurt us. They have to be able to see your wounds and feel them as well. John 20, here's what happens. Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." After he said this, he showed them his hands and his side. Then the disciples rejoiced when they saw the Lord. A week later, his disciples were again in the house and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were shut, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here. See my hands. Reach out your hand and put it in my side. Do not doubt, but believe." Thomas answered, "My Lord and my God." And when they had gone ashore, this is later in John 21, the next story, they saw a charcoal fire there with fish on it and bread. And Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." Now none of the disciples dared to ask him, "Who are you?" because they knew it was the Lord. Jesus came took the bread and gave it to them and did the same with the fish. What does it look like to be the forgiving victim? What does it look like to play into this new story God is telling? You know, I don't think this model we see in two chapters here plays out in that short a time for us. I think sometimes it could take years, possibly even generations, for this to be a fully realized process. But I think the process must reflect exactly what we see modeled in Jesus' resurrection, an offer of peace, an offer of intention. I come to you not looking for vengeance, not looking to get even, but because I want to reconcile, to forgive. I think it has to begin with the removal of any fear and hostilities, laying our weapons down, and then showcasing our wounds. There's no skipping this process. A perpetrator must both see and feel the wounds they have inflicted. But that's why the offer of peace must come first. Exposing of wounds is not done with the intention of revenge or retaliation. It comes only after an offer of peace and desire to reconcile and forgive. And then the last one, Jesus. Now let's eat. Come back to the table. Come back to community. Let's do this. Let's sit together around the table and eat. And I know there are some wounds that are so severe, this won't be able to happen this side of eternity. I get that. But I think the model is there for us. And why this is so important is this, as Michael Harden so powerfully reminds us, God cannot break through to the persecutor when the victim is retaliatory. So the question for me, for us this Easter is this, what do you really want? What do we culturally really want? Revenge? Or do we legitimately want a better world to live in? Do we want retaliation? Or do we earnestly desire that God's kingdom would come on earth as it is in heaven? If the latter, then the call is this: come to know the forgiving victim, and in that take on the role of forgiving victim yourself. I'm going to ask Dave to come and help us close. But this is why one of the things we want to do is this Tuesday we're having a Nexus Connects event. We're going to talk about what it means to disagree well with one another. And so I hope you'll join us for that. It's why we're having an event like Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, because I think what's so important is just getting people around a table and eating together. There's information out there in the foyer in the Nexus Weekly about that. But that's why we do these things, to initiate the process, to follow the forgiving victim model. And so the question is this: is the story of the forgiving victim revealed at Easter true? Is Jesus, the forgiving victim, truly the hope of the world? For me, this Easter, in this time, in this place, I feel like all I can do is cry out the prayer of Mark 9. Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. Easter isn't just the shock of being forgiven by your victim. It's about living under the story of Jesus rather than the story of Horace or Hollywood. And in a world that's trapped in reciprocal bouts of fighting and violence and woundedness, all the way from the very petty right up to the genocidal, in a world that's stuck believing that the story of our world only has two characters, victim and persecutor, we speak of a plot twist. There's a new character. His name is Jesus. He comes as the forgiving victim and calls us to that same role. And that is the hope of the world. Today is Easter Sunday. We celebrate hope. We proclaim our victim has come back from the dead and is looking for us. It's news that should make us want to hide in fear. It's news that shouldn't be considered good news at all, but it is. It is good news because the story has changed. What we find in the resurrection is not just a victim raised from the dead, but a forgiving victim who calls us to play the same role. For me, this morning, that is the good news I'm trying to believe and live into. And so that's the question for all of us. Whose resurrection do you believe in? Horace or Jesus?